This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Some of the people camped out in Occupy Wall Street all over the country have nowhere else to go. As reported by Associated Press, Occupy encampments from Portland, Oregon, through L.A. to Atlanta are finding homeless people moving into tent cities set up by protesters. Some Occupy sites are finding bylaws written to send away the homeless are being used to prevent constitutional rights of freedom of assembly and expression. Polls show millions of Americans are just one paycheck away from losing their homes. Many more are already in foreclosure, being evicted, or already out on the street. Lots of us worry, could I be next? Could you handle it? The way things are now, maybe the rights of the homeless will matter to you down the line. Radio EcoShock is going to take you on a quick tour of homelessness in North America. We'll visit New York City, where 36,000 school children have no home. San Francisco, where it is illegal to sit or lie on a sidewalk. Even in the capital, in Washington, D.C., we'll find the homeless next to the limousines and lobbyists. In Canada, there is a little progress in Vancouver, with street sleepers reduced by 80%, but are they just being hidden away?
I got an idea about homelessness. You know what they ought to do? Change the name of it. Change the name of it. It's not homelessness. It's houselessness. It's houses these people need. A home is an abstract idea. A home is a setting. It's a state of mind. These people need houses, physical, tangible structures. They need low-cost housing. But where are you going to put it? Well, that's fine, but where are you going to put it? Where are you going to put it? Nobody wants you to build low-cost housing near their house. People don't want it near them. We got something in this country. You've heard of it. It's called NIMBY. N-I-M-B-Y. Not in my backyard. People don't want anything, any kind of social help located anywhere near them. You try to open up a halfway house. Try to open up a drug rehab or an alcohol rehab center. Try to do a homeless shelter somewhere. Try to open up a little home for some retarded people who want to work their way into the community. People say, not in my backyard. People don't want anything near them, especially if it might help somebody else.
There are somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million homeless people in America. The wild thing is, America is flooded with empty houses. 1 in 10 homes in the United States is vacant. That's about 18 million homes. If we guesstimate, there are as many as 500,000 families needing a home. There are 18 empty homes for every one of them. When the Soviet Union collapsed in 1989, all housing was owned by the government. As Dmitry Orlov has told us on Radio EcoShock, people just stayed where they were, so there was no wave of homelessness in Russia or its member states during those harsh economic times. But America is stuck. Houses sit empty, sometimes the banks even tear them down, but people, many of them families with young children, keep getting foreclosed, evicted, kicked out onto the street, and nobody wants them. Apparently capitalism just can't handle degrowth. As winter approaches and the economy heads into the dumpster, homelessness is growing in New York City. The nasty surprise is that both the state and city appear to be slashing help for the homeless in their hour of greatest need. Radio EcoShock visits the Big Apple with Giselle Routhier, policy analyst for the NYC Coalition for the Homeless. We'll talk with Jennifer Freidenbach, executive director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. Why has this formerly welcoming city gone into a media orgy of bashing the poor? We'll go to Washington, D.C. to speak with Michael Farrell, executive director of the district's Coalition for the Homeless, to see what is going on there. Our last stop is Vancouver, Canada, with famous anti-poverty activist Gene Swanson of the Carnegie Community Action Project and author of the book Poor Bashing, The Politics of Exclusion. This ain't no social cause. Homelessness in a land of wealth is a national disgrace. In San Francisco, we learn the city has stopped counting the number of homeless people found dead on the streets every year. The average is at least 100 dead in just one city. An estimated 37,000 homeless Americans die every year. That is more than in any foreign war. About 155 of them are murdered, some as hate crimes for the fun of it, or out of a desire to kill someone vulnerable. You won't see this on TV, but there is a National Homeless Persons Memorial Day on December 21st, 2011, to remember those victims of a system that just didn't care. World Homeless Day this year was on October 10th. Remember that? All the news specials and the coverage? I didn't think so. Let's take a tour of the tragedy of homelessness in North America. Radio EcoShock visits the Big Apple with Giselle Routhier, policy analyst for the NYC Coalition for the Homeless. Hello, Giselle.
Hello.
Last spring, your organization released a State of the Homeless 2011 report. What did you find?
Well, what we found is that over the past year, in 2010, homelessness in New York City reached record levels. Throughout the year in 2010, over 113,500 men, women, and children slept in New York City shelters, and that includes 42,000 children. And that was the highest level recorded within a year-long period. And then what we also saw was that the average nightly census numbers among homeless folks in shelter also reached record highs in the past year as well. So in February, we saw that there were over 39,000 men, women, and children in shelters on a single night. So that's what we've been seeing over the past year. That's what we documented in our report. It has a lot to do with both the economy, but a little bit more to do with the policies of this mayoral administration and what's being done to assist the homeless.
Well, let's be clear. Absolute records are being set in total homeless people in New York, the number of homeless families and kids and more. But I did a Google search for recent news about the plight of these citizens of New York in the last month, and it showed practically nothing. Are the homeless being hidden?
I think it's more of a hidden problem, I would say, specific to New York as well. In New York City, we actually have a right to shelter. That exists in nowhere else in the country. So the majority of folks that are homeless in New York City are going to be in a shelter, which makes the problem much more hidden, even though it is still a huge problem. So you do see fewer people on the streets here in New York, although you see that as well. But because we have a right to shelter, the vast majority of people that are homeless are in shelters.
Well, Giselle, tell us more about the response to these record numbers. Let's start with the state of New York.
Well, it's more, I think I would say more of a city kind of problem that we're seeing. Specifically starting, you know, in 2005, we've seen these numbers go up. So before the economy even tanked, we started seeing the numbers of homeless families, homeless men and women going up. And that's directly related to some of the policy changes that they made on a city level. So in 2005, Mayor Bloomberg decided to cut off homeless families and individuals from gaining access to federal housing resources. So what I mean by federal housing resources are Section 8 vouchers, public housing, so the type of permanent housing that's funded by the federal government. So prior to that, homeless families would get a priority on the top of the long waiting list for those resources and be able to access a certain portion of Section 8 vouchers and public housing. So in 2005, the mayor stopped that, and since then, virtually no homeless families have gotten access to those resources. And what he did instead was institute these time-limited city-funded subsidies. So they've gone through several different iterations, but the latest one was called Advantage. It was time-limited to 2 years. And what we've seen since that program was put into effect was that yes, it would help families move out, but there are more and more families coming back into the shelter system after their 2 years runs out. So what we've seen since 2005 is a huge increase in the number of families that are experiencing a repeat episode of homelessness, so coming back into the system after exiting for a brief period of time. And so that has fed significantly to the numbers that naturally went up when the economy tanked. So that sort of compounded that problem, and now we have record numbers. And at the beginning of this year, the mayor ended the time-limited subsidies as well. So we have now, for the first time ever, no program in place to help families move out of shelter, whether permanent housing or temporary. And it's causing massive problems, and we're still not quite seeing, you know, what the effect of that might be, because it was just earlier this year that they families got cut off from all subsidies. So I think what we're going to be seeing in the coming months, especially fall and winter, when we sometimes see a rise in homelessness, is that it's just going to be astronomical.
Giselle, let's talk about homeless kids in New York City classrooms. The New York City Department of Homeless Services reported 8,000 school-aged children have no home, but the federal government said it was more like 40,000 kids. What's going on there?
That's right. There is a broader, the federal government uses a broader definition of homelessness. So what the city is measuring is specifically children that are in homeless shelters. The federal government uses a broader definition, so that would include people who are in homeless shelters or families that are living in doubled-up situations or with other family members or don't have a nightly place to go that's the same, that's consistent. So it's a broader definition that the federal government uses, so it does capture more students that are living in situations that are not permanent or unstable.
So if these kids are going back to shelters, there is a right to shelter. Are they getting a chance to shower? Do they have a place to do their homework? Is it going to work for them?
I mean, there's a place to shower, but it does disrupt children's lives. I mean, the research has consistently shown over the past several decades that homeless kids face a lot of barriers in schooling and will most of the time be underachieving in school compared to other poor children that are housed. And that's because of, you know, a lot of different things. They're seeing instability in their lives. It's difficult to find a place, like you said, to do their homework that's quiet, that's not around a lot of other people. They've been uprooted. They're facing a lot of times emotional distress or behavioral problems, and a lot of these things compound into directly causing an underachievement in school or seeing a decline in their achievement in school. So that is definitely an issue. I mean, we've also seen in studies that as soon as a family is rehoused and permanent, then a student can rebound very well. But while they're homeless, that added stress from what they're experiencing is very real.
Rocker Cyndi Lauper has recently thrown the spotlight on the number of lesbian, gay, and transgender youth on the streets of New York. Some of them were kicked out by their parents and now live in a risky environment. Are you seeing this problem?
That's definitely a problem in New York City, and it's a very specific population, and it's tough, too, because New York City does have a right to shelter, but this is a population that by nature is sometimes tough to serve or will feel unsafe in a larger city shelter with men and women of all different ages and different sexual orientations. And so a lot of times kids that are running away from home and facing a myriad of other problems will prefer to stay on the streets than going into the shelter. And so there are some specialized shelter and services for those kids, but not enough to meet the need. So that is a big issue in terms of getting specific services to really address needs of younger homeless kids and homeless LGBT kids. And we don't see enough of that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Giselle Routhier, policy analyst with the New York City Coalition for the Homeless. Giselle, I'd like to run through a rapid-fire checklist on the rights of the homeless in New York. Please try to give me fast answers if you can, even yes or no if that works. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Is it legal in New York for a homeless person to sit on the sidewalk?
Yes, as long as they're not blocking traffic.
How about a homeless family? Can they sleep in a public place?
Again, it sort of depends. Public parks have curfews, so that would generally be a no, but we've encountered families who've slept in laundromats or in restaurants or other places. So people tend to get interesting when they need to find a place to sleep outside.
Is there anywhere in greater New York area where homeless people can legally pitch a tent to live in?
I'm actually unaware of that. I really don't know what that would be. Like I said, you know, if it was in the New York City five boroughs, you know, the only place I could think of that they would do that would be in a park, but in public parks there are curfews or the parks close at midnight, so I don't see how that would really happen. As far as outside of New York City, I can't say.
Okay. Is it legal to sleep in a car or camper in New York?
Yeah.
Does New York have public washrooms accessible to the homeless?
Again, folks that are living on the streets will get creative in terms of finding what they need, but there are public restrooms throughout the city.
Good. Do we know how many homeless New Yorkers are found dead on the streets each winter?
I do not have that information. No, I do not know.
Okay. Can a homeless person vote in state elections?
Yes, of course.
Can the homeless vote in city elections?
Yes, of course.
And my final one, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the New York City police if 10 is where the officers protect the homeless and 1 is where the homeless are generally harassed or beaten by the police? Your rating of the police?
I would say it's on the lower end. You know, for the most part, the police will try to move homeless folks along. But in a lot of circumstances, they'll leave them alone if they're not causing any trouble. So it's, you know, maybe 50-50.
Okay, let's go for longer talk here. First, the New York Times reports 1 in 5 New Yorkers are living below the poverty line. Other news reports show the general welfare rate in New York City has fallen by 4%, but welfare numbers are skyrocketing in surrounding areas like Long Island. Giselle, has there been an assessment of how many people are homeless because we don't treat their mental health or medical problems? Do we have any idea how that stands?
The data on that is pretty hard to measure. I mean, one thing we do know is that the rates of mental illness among homeless single adults are higher than among the general population. And we also know that among those that sleep on the streets, the rates of mental illness are higher than those that are in the shelter system. But it's hard to say. I don't think there's been any way to accurately measure what leads or in how many instances the reason they're homeless is because of their mental illness or other disability.
And the New York Coalition for the Homeless is one of the oldest such institutions in the country. Giselle Ruthier, what are your organization priorities for the coming winter of discomfort for those 100,000 and more New Yorkers who will need services this winter?
Our biggest priority this winter is really advocating that the city put in place some type of program to give a solution to folks that are in shelters. So our biggest priority is to get the city to reinstate priority for federal housing resources for homeless families and individuals. So that's the biggest thing. I mean, it won't cost the city anything, and it will provide immediate housing resources to homeless families and individuals who at the moment have none. So that's been our biggest focus. I mean, aside from that, we do also, you know, keep track of the amount of shelter capacity that the city has and make sure they have enough to meet the need. But what we'd rather see is actually folks moving out into permanent housing, and that's something that there is a complete lack of a plan right now. So that's what we're going to be focusing on.
Giselle, can you give us your website address and maybe tell us how we can help?
Absolutely. Our website is www.coalitionforthehomeless.org. And there's a lot of information on our website about what's happening in New York City with the homeless population. There's statistics. There's a take action page to write to the mayor and write to the city and about what they can do to improve the situation. So I would encourage anybody to really check that out.
Obviously, we've just touched the surface in a deep problem in the financial capital of the world. Our guest is Giselle Ruthier from the New York Coalition for the Homeless. Thank you, Giselle.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
California love. California is nice to the homeless. California, super cool to the homeless. In the city of Santa Monica, lots of rich people giving change to the homeless.
Change?
We continue our survey of homelessness in major cities. Jennifer Friedenbach is the executive director of the San Francisco Coalition for Homelessness. Jennifer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Do you think there is a connection between the Occupy San Francisco movement and the plight of the homeless?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, a lot of the folks that are involved in Occupy San Francisco are without housing themselves. And I think that a lot of folks are protesting what has happened to the financial industry and what the financial industry has done to the economy of the United States. And so folks have lost their housing, folks are out of work, folks are really struggling, and they don't see the response they'd like to see. And a lot of things go back to the financial industry's fault.
Right. The homeowners didn't get bailed out. They just got the dirty end of the stick.
Right, exactly. And in fact, interestingly enough, the same sector also funded laws in San Francisco that made it illegal to sit and lie on San Francisco sidewalks. They funded those campaigns. The last campaign, about 70% of the funding came from the financial sector. We also have the financial sector and places like Wells Fargo funding the creation of private prisons in the United States. We also have a lot of price gouging going on for people who are just regular customers of banks that's hurting people economically. And there's just a lot of stuff going on. We have the cities are in a situation where they're making cuts to social programs that impacts homeless people and other low-income people. And oftentimes the localities are making cuts because their pension funds are losing money, or alternatively, usually both, they got really bad loans from the financial industry for bonds that were issued. And so there's a lot of push to try to renegotiate those bonds so that then the city can save money and stave off cuts to social services. So it's all very much connected.
It's one big circle. And could you explain for us this sit-lie-buy law? How did it come about, and what does it really mean for people who have no home?
Well, you know, really, from our perspective, it was put on the ballot. There's in San Francisco, like a lot of big American cities, homelessness is used as political football for folks who are running for office. And there, it's also used locally as a wedge issue on the ballot to try to drive more conservative voters to the poll and impact elections. And we believe that's why sit-lie was put on the ballot, was one of our districts that could have gone either way, liberal or conservative, and was up for re-election, and we've always believed that that's why it was put on the ballot. It basically means 30 days in jail on the second offense for anyone sitting or lying on sidewalks in San Francisco, and it doesn't require a witness, and it does not require, of course, a crime to be committed. So from a civil rights perspective, it's a very problematic law. Interestingly enough, there's been talk of using it against the protesters, and the chief of police decided actually that they were not going to use it against the protesters, that they're going to selectively enforce the law. So in other words, they're using it against people who they deem to be sitting or lying on the sidewalk because they're too poor to afford a place to live and they would be in violation versus people who are there because they're in protest. So it's pretty problematic from a civil rights perspective.
Is that 24/7 or are there certain hours where you can't just sit down?
It's time specific. And so there's other laws. There's actually 33 laws that are on the books that target poor people. And some of them are state laws and some of them are local laws. But yeah, that was our sit-lie law was number 33.
Are there more homeless people in the Bay Area as the economy fails to recover?
There is, absolutely. We have in San Francisco, we have the highest wait list for shelters for families that we've ever had. It reached a high point last week, in fact. And we have, you know, about half as many more single adults than before looking for housing. The interesting thing is about, in both the families and the folks who don't have kids, about 60% of them are homeless for the first time. So we have people who, you know, that are newly homeless that have never experienced this before. They're mostly all poor people. You know, I mean, this kind of idea that for folks who have access to accumulated wealth, they're likely not going to become homeless, and more likely it's going to be low-income working-class people who don't have access to accumulated wealth, who don't have families that, you know, have large houses that they can move into when times get tough.
Well, if this happens all of a sudden to somebody, and it can, you just suddenly come home and you're evicted, what is a person to do? What are the first steps that a person could take?
Well, I think the most important thing for folks is to try to stay in their housing, of course. It's much more difficult once you lose your housing. So to do that, there's oftentimes local programs that'll give rental assistance. And part of the Obama stimulus package, the first one around, was this program that does homeless prevention over a longer period of time. So let's say you're out of work for 9 months, they'll help you pay your rent during that time. There's programs that people should check with their municipal government, try to stay in housing. I think the other thing to do is to really reach out and be resourceful, you know, reach out to everyone you know and find out if folks can help you out. And I think that our culture has kind of isolated us from one another, and this idea that we all kind of stand independently, but, you know, folks are willing to help and are happy to do it oftentimes. And so that's what folks should keep in mind as well. There may be local shelters, et cetera, that folks can access, but I think the more immediate thing is to stay in your housing, and if you can't stay in your housing, to be resourceful with your own network and reach out to families and friends about folks who can put you up.
And I guess if that doesn't work, your other resource is other homeless people who will tell you where you can get a meal and where you can get by.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in different localities, they have different resource lists and different systems on how to access shelter, et cetera. But, you know, a lot of that information can be available electronically on the web in most municipalities.
And you mentioned that families are having to wait to get into a shelter. How long are they having to wait? And it's hard for me to picture this. What does a single mother with three kids do while waiting for a shelter? Where are they living?
In San Francisco right now, it's about a 6 to 9 month wait. So what families are doing is, you know, they're moving from place to place. You know, they'll move in with for a few nights with some friends, maybe a few nights in a hotel, maybe a few nights with family, and just keep trying to put different things together, sometimes sleeping in their cars. So, yeah, folks really, it's really destabilizing. Unfortunately, a lot of times the families end up splitting up. So maybe the kids go stay with someone and then the parents have to stay somewhere else. That's a pretty typical situation. Sometimes for single women, they have to make choices around, you know, stay in places that are not always very safe if they're a single mom. And that's a very uncomfortable, terrible decision that folks are faced with. So it's really traumatizing. It's a very, very difficult situation. And, of course, because, you know, human beings are, you know, we're not meant to live outdoors. We're meant to, you know, we really have this natural tendency towards home. And it's really incredibly traumatizing for people.
How many homeless school children are there in Frisco, and how are they coping?
We have close to 2,000, and so that would be school-aged, registered in our public schools. I know that there's been some national numbers that the numbers are pretty staggering nationwide, and they really are going up and up because the school districts keep track of, you know, how many kids they have without housing in their district. So it's, yeah, it's really, really a tough situation. And it's, you know, when we have families that are in this situation and then get housing, they talk so much about the difference it has made for their kids in terms of their ability to succeed at school and what the family relationships are like. And every part of the life just is totally transformed when they have safe and dignified housing to live in. So it really does impact kids in a lot of ways. You know, for really little kids, maybe, you know, there's a lot of kids don't reach their developmental milestones if they don't have a place to live. So, you know, you think about kids crawling at a certain age, you know, about 7 months to 9 months and starting to walk at 1 year. And if you don't have a home and you're constantly in a stroller all day, every day, and you're moving around, those developmental milestones just don't get hit. And education, the same kind of impact. So kids really struggle with it. It's really very destabilizing for them.
Jennifer Friedenbach, local newspapers have run horror stories about panhandling in the city. What is your take?
You know, this is another one of those election things. We've been doing a ton of outreach. We've been talking to everybody that's involved in the panhandling, you know, panhandlers and street performers and all kinds of folks, and nobody has noted an increase in panhandling. So we kind of think of it as an election ploy. We see it. We have a mayoral election coming on right now. Typically, we would see an increase in panhandling with an economic downturn. We haven't found any evidence of that, you know, but that's the sign of poverty in any country, in any culture, place in the world. You're going to basically be able to see what level of poverty exists in a society by the numbers of panhandlers. It's a very common indicator. And so, you know, in San Francisco, we have a pretty high level of poverty. We have half of our school children in San Francisco are having free or reduced lunch, which means that they're living below the poverty line. And living below in the poverty line in San Francisco, which is a very expensive city to live in, both food and rent and other cost of living indicators, is a real struggle. So, you know, we have a very affluent city, but really we have two cities. We have extremely poor people and extremely affluent people.
Yeah, that's sort of what Occupy Wall Street is about, I think, for sure. How is San Francisco doing when it comes to providing supportive housing as a long-term solution for homeless people?
I think San Francisco's been pretty good in terms of really trying to ensure that a large amount of the general fund goes towards creating supportive housing. And that ends up, from a fiscal perspective, a very smart thing to do because you save so much money in emergency costs and criminal justice costs and all these other kind of societal costs. So it's actually a lot less expensive for folks to be in housing than to be out on the streets for a municipality. So emergency room visits alone, because of what happens to somebody if they're living outside, colds turning into pneumonia, infections turning into loss of limbs. I mean, all these things, it really is very costly. So that we're pretty smart about it. We're nowhere near meeting the need. The homeless crisis, of course, was caused by the federal government's massive cuts, especially previous to 1983, and we reached our lowest point in 1983, and our first shelters opened up around the country. And since then, our homeless population has only grown because we really haven't invested in the housing that we had after the New Deal. And so that steady deterioration of housing, of affordable housing, has led to, and that and the growing disparity between wages and rents, has grown to this crisis that we're facing. So till the federal government really gets serious about solving the problems and making a commitment to the very basic human right of housing, localities are going to continue to struggle with this issue.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Jennifer Friedenbach, Executive Director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. Jennifer, I think we're doing pretty well here. Do you have some more time? We could keep going?
Sure.
Okay. Well, in New York City, we found up to 40% of the young homeless aged 18 to 24 were partly there due to gender issues, being lesbian, gay, or transgender. Should we presume that's a problem in San Francisco, and what is being done to address their needs?
In San Francisco, we definitely are a mecca in terms of folks coming here who are persecuted because of their LGBT status in other areas. And when they come, you know, they're often find that there's no resources here to help them or very little. And so we absolutely have that issue here in San Francisco of young people who, you know, they don't have the family or, you know, the support system in place to help them, you know, and young people really need that, especially nowadays. It's very difficult to live independently because of that rent income disparity and the amount of income that young people are going to be able to earn. It's very difficult to afford rent. So absolutely, that's an issue here.
Jennifer, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions as we compare the rights of the homeless in San Francisco to other cities. Please try to give me a few fast answers if you can, even yes or no if that works. Are you ready?
Sure.
Is it legal for a homeless family to sleep in a public place in San Francisco?
Yes. It's illegal.
It's illegal?
Yeah.
Okay, can't do it. Is there anywhere in San Francisco area where homeless people can legally pitch a tent to live in?
No, there's nowhere legally they can pitch a tent to live in.
Okay. Is it legal to sleep in a car or camper in San Francisco?
It is illegal.
Cannot do that either. So if I'm found sleeping in a car, the police officer will ask me to do something else.
Exactly.
Okay. Does San Francisco have public washrooms accessible to the homeless?
It has some, but very limited.
Do we know how many homeless people in San Francisco are found dead on the streets each winter?
We stopped doing the count several years ago. The City Department of Public Health decided to stop doing it for political reasons, but usually, by word of mouth, we find at least 100.
Can a homeless person vote in state elections?
Yes.
Can the homeless vote in city elections?
Yes.
And final question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate the San Francisco police if 10 is where officers protect the homeless and 1 is the homeless are generally harassed or even beaten by the police? Your rating of San Francisco police?
Probably around a 3 or 4.
Well, Jennifer, let's get back to more extended issues. I began by pointing out in these uncertain times anybody could lose their job. You've mentioned that it's mostly poor people. Are you seeing some middle-class people who are surprised that they just don't have any options now?
We see some. That is not going to be as typical. I mean, I think folks who, for example, folks who are middle-class but maybe had steady income but didn't come from a legacy of accumulated wealth, maybe they were the first one in their families to get a college degree or, you know, this kind of thing. And they really don't have a lot to fall back on. You know, middle class is kind of a mushy word. And so we're never really sure what that means. But certainly most people who are homeless are, you know, are work, what we would consider working class, folks who definitely spent most of their life working, but probably at lower wage jobs that don't have a lot of stability.
Well, Jennifer, just give me a minute to talk about a problem which relates to corporate greed and the Ponzi housing crash. This homeless crisis in the U.S. all sounds a little crazy to an outsider. California has a record number of empty houses. Most of them are ultimately owned, or at least the mortgage is guaranteed by the federal government agency like Fannie Mae. And we have crowds of people with kids out on the street while thousands of homes sit empty. Do you think America will figure out a solution to that?
I think we can. I think we absolutely can. And I think that with political will and with a commitment at the federal level, we could solve this housing crisis relatively quickly. And we could have even done it with 30 days of Iraq war spending, for example. We could have housed every man, woman, and child through the rest of their lifetimes just with the amount of money we spent in 30 days. So it really is a matter of political will. And I think for the United States, it's an incredibly important issue that we make sure all of our people are housed.
Well, that leads to the question, why do we tolerate homelessness?
You know, our political system really, you know, has favored greed. And we have a situation where, you know, in the United States, greed rules in so many different ways. And we really need to change that around, where we come from a place of human rights. We come from a place of dignity and mutual respect for all human beings.
Well, back on working with the homeless, what are your priorities for the coming winter for the people in San Francisco?
Well, for us, we're working on identifying empty buildings. We're going to try to, you know, hopefully get them turned over to families and other homeless people. Certainly our priorities is we're trying to get another shelter opened up. We are also working hard to make sure that the civil and human rights of people who are forced to remain on the streets are upheld.
Please give us your website address and tell us how we can help.
So you can get a hold of us through cohsf.org. So that's the initials for Coalition on Homelessness, sanfrancisco.org, and that's our website. And folks can help. Certainly, if you're local to San Francisco, you can get involved in our struggle. We are supported totally by individual donations, very small foundation support, and folks can subscribe to our newspaper, The Street Sheet, and get it mailed to them. They can also give us donations online.
Is there anything I missed? Something else you'd like to add?
No, just that I think that one of the things for folks to think about, and I know listeners are, you know, really disturbed by this idea of becoming homeless themselves or other folks becoming homeless. And I think, you know, we have to move from a sympathetic apathy state to a very active state. And folks can do all kinds of stuff to help. And it's really important to do that, you know, whether it's passing out socks to people or getting involved in a local struggle to create a housing bond that will house low-income people. But these are all things that people can get involved in, and by doing just, you know, a few hours a week to a whole lot more.
Our guest is Jennifer Friedenbach, and she's the executive director of the San Francisco Coalition on Homelessness. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
The only metaphor we have in our public discourse for solving a problem is called declaring a war. We've got a war on poverty, the war on crime, war on litter, the war on cancer, the war on drugs. But you ever notice there's no war on homelessness, is there? Nah, no war on homelessness. You know why? There's no money in that problem. There's no money in that problem. Nobody stands. It's true. Nobody stands to get rich off of that problem. You could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of million dollars each. You see the streets of America begin to clear up pretty goddamn quick. I'll guarantee you that. I will guarantee you that.
Our next stop in the Radio EcoShock survey of homelessness in America is the nation's capital, Washington, D.C., in a city of 600,000 people, stuffed with lobbyists, lawmakers, and limousines. The number of homeless people in the District of Columbia has gone up 10% since the economic downturn in 2007. Michael Farrell is the executive director of the District's Coalition for the Homeless. Michael, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you.
Well, as we speak, Occupy DC continues along with a series of planned national protests in the Capitol. Do you think there's a connection to the problem of homelessness?
Well, certainly there are some issues that cross over into the whole Occupy Wall Street piece. But I think fundamentally the principal difference is we're talking about persons who were once employed, who are now unemployed, who are seeking opportunities, in addition to recent college graduates who have either not been able to secure employment or have had employment off and on. And the individuals who were homeless and still are homeless prior to this, while they are unemployed, they have other issues which may include alcohol and substance abuse and mental health issues.
Right. So there's some crossover, but the problem of homelessness has been with us for a while.
Exactly.
I want to talk about numbers here for a second. During the big snow dump in January 2011, there was an annual point-of-time survey, and it found almost 12,000 people in shelters and around the town spread over the place without an official home. And yet the official numbers of homeless people for D.C. hover around 6,500. Why the big difference?
Well, the number for the region, the Washington, D.C. region, exactly was 11,988. Which represented approximately a 2% increase over the count that was reported in 2010. When you look at the District of Columbia for the same period, the numbers were also basically in that same range. For 2010, the number was 6,539 compared to 6,546 in 2011. So there was no material difference in the count for those 2 years. So when you look at homelessness overall in D.C. and Washington metropolitan region, it has been fairly stable. We've seen some minor fluctuations in the 1% to 2% range, plus or minus.
So it seems like the sort of lack of jobs and the economy haven't made a big change in the last few years anyway. Is that what you're saying?
Not directly. Where we're seeing the change is on how homelessness is affecting families with children. In this particular area, we have seen an increase, and let me try to clarify that. While the overall numbers have remained basically flat for the region, the homeless count for single adults declined. On the other hand, the homeless count for persons in families increased. And we certainly see that directly tied to the poor economy. With respect to the single adults, there are two variables that really had a very pressing impact on how homelessness affected single adults. And that is the federal stimulus dollars, which provided dollars for permanent supportive housing. So individuals who are chronically homeless had a resource that could be used to house them and place them out of shelter into some form of permanent supportive housing. And permanent supportive housing is housing that provides supportive social services. The other aspect of stimulus dollars also provided funds for prevention. And so that also was beneficial to some single adults, as well as rapid rehousing. And those funds were used for individuals who became homeless and were able to rehouse them more quickly than if the funds were not readily available.
Are you going to be able to keep that federal funding?
The federal funding is running out, and that varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction in the region, but it's pretty safe to say that by mid-2012, those funds will be completely exhausted.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Michael Farrell, Executive Director of the District of Columbia Coalition on Homelessness. Mike, I've been asking a few quick questions to compare the rights of homeless people in different cities. Please try to give me some fast answers if you can, even yes or no, if that works. Are you ready?
Sure.
Is it legal in Washington for a homeless person to sit on the sidewalk during the daytime?
Yes.
Is it legal for a homeless family to sleep in a public place?
No.
Is there anywhere in the Washington area where homeless people can legally pitch a tent to live in?
No.
Is it legal to sleep in a car or camper in Washington, D.C.?
Camper, yes. Car, no.
Does the district have public washrooms accessible to the homeless?
Some.
Would you say enough?
No, I'd say there are some public wash place facilities available in the district. There are few, but there are some.
Okay. Are homeless people in Washington found dead on the streets during the winter?
On a year-by-year basis, unfortunately, there are individuals who do die due to exposure or hypothermia. I can't quote the exact number from last year, but it usually has averaged somewhere in roughly between 2 to 4 individuals might die from hypothermia-related issues.
Can a homeless person vote in federal elections and municipal elections?
In the district, yes.
Okay. Can convicted felons vote in elections in Washington?
No.
And last one, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate Washington police if 10 is where officers protect the homeless and 1 is where the homeless are generally harassed or even beaten by police? How would you rate the D.C. police?
5.
Okay, right in the middle there. From Washington, D.C., my guest is Michael Farrell. I've just heard D.C. plans to teach homeless people the skills to fix up some of the city's abandoned property. In exchange, the volunteers get to live there for 2 years. That seems to make sense. Is it a good program?
I think it is an excellent program. It represents an opportunity for persons who are homeless or low income, the opportunity to become homeowners. And certainly the fact that they are actively involved in renovating that housing in order to prepare it for them to live in is certainly an appropriate and good idea.
And they pick up some construction skills along the way.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, Washington has temporary assistance for needy families, also known as TANF, and I found one report that showed 99% of people receiving that benefit are African Americans. So couldn't you talk to us about African Americans and homelessness in the nation's capital?
Well, in the nation's capital, unfortunately, the majority of the persons who experience homelessness are African American, and that's hovering around 91%. And when you consider that the district now is about 50% African American, there clearly is a disproportionate number of African Americans in the district who are experiencing homelessness relative to the overall population.
And, you know, people tend to think of homeless people as chronic substance abusers. There are some, but I found one survey in D.C. showing there are 3 times more folks in shelters with chronic health problems. And it leads me to wonder, is homelessness disguising the lack of medical care for poor people in America?
Well, I think it bears further examination because there are individuals who have multiple issues that may include a chronic health problem, could also include a chronic drug and or alcohol problem or some mental health problems. And so it really is bears, you know, further examination to kind of tease out which came first and which is, you know, really the more pressing issue. When you look at drug and alcohol abuse, you know, as a primary cause for a person's healthcare issues, it takes on a slightly different dimension versus, you know, someone who, and not to marginalize it, has a heart condition or HIV/AIDS or high blood pressure or diabetes. All of these things can be found certainly in the general population.
Well, if I head into a D.C. shelter and I'm obviously pretty sick, am I going to get to go to a hospital or see a doctor?
Certainly, if an individual requires emergency care, an ambulance, you know, will be called and the person would receive appropriate medical attention. In a non-emergency situation, the district has what they call the D.C. Healthcare Alliance, and persons who are homeless and low income have access to health care, you know, through the D.C. Healthcare Alliance. Now, the question becomes, do the individuals opt to avail themselves of those resources? And that varies on a case-by-case basis.
Michael, what are your priorities for the coming winter for people in D.C. who need homeless services?
Well, the primary priority for the winter and our winter season in the district begins November 1st and running through March 31st of next year is to make sure that there is adequate shelter available for anyone who needs it. For those individuals who choose not to go into shelter, the district has a hypothermia alert plan that will send vans out around the streets to identify persons who are homeless and who choose to stay on the streets, to provide them with blankets and coffee and tea and hot soup. in order to help them to sustain themselves if they choose to remain on the streets. The hypothermia hotline number is generally available to the public so that they can make calls for individuals who may be in distress on the street, and if citizens use that number, a van will be dispatched to that location to check on the status of the individuals homeless and on the streets.
As we wrap up, can you give us your website address and tell how D.C. listeners can help?
Our website address is www.dcfhouse.org. And people can certainly help by making contributions, donating their time, and also since we're on the verge of the winter season in particular, you know, donating warm clothing items, coats and hats and gloves and boots and socks and things of that nature.
Our guest is Michael Farrell from the Coalition for the Homeless. Thank you so much, Michael.
Well, thank you. Have a great day.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
Good evening. Our top story tonight, Vancouver's battle with homelessness has been won. After years of struggling with increasing rates of homelessness, tonight Vancouver will finally house its last homeless person, making it a model for cities around the world.
From Vancouver, we're honored to welcome a long-standing advocate for the poor. Jean Swanson is the coordinator of the Carnegie Community Action Project. She helps people of the downtown East Side, one of the poorest neighborhoods in the country. An award-winning organizer, Jean Swanson is author of the book Poor Bashing, The Politics of Exclusion. Jean, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks.
Jean, we're taking a quick sort of multi-city reading of the homeless situation. I understand there's finally a bit of good news for the homeless in Vancouver. The mayor, Gregor Robertson, just announced the count of homeless people actually on the street has gone down from 800 last year to about 145 this year. Can you tell us some of the positive developments that other cities might learn from?
Well, I just want to make a small correction there. Homelessness actually went up in the latest count. It's just that the number of homeless people who are in shelters as opposed to the number on the street went up. So more people are in shelters now than before. So that's a positive thing. It's a sort of positive thing. Another sort of positive thing is that in Canada, you don't have to have kids to get welfare. So people in Canada can get welfare, and they can, if they have disabilities, they can get a disability pension. So they do have a little bit of money to pay for rent, but it's only $375, and there's virtually no place available for $375 for the rent of $375. So it's really hard, but it's at least better than it is in the States in that way. And since the mayor has come in, he's been working on opening more shelters. But the bad news side is we just learned that the province isn't going to fund 160 shelter beds that they did fund last year.
So we're winning and losing. But there have been some supportive housing spots being built in the city?
Well, you got to take the long-term look at it. Back in the 80s, we had a national housing program, and the feds put money into housing, which they're virtually not doing now. So back in the 80s, there were about 600 units of social housing a year that got built in Vancouver. A recent survey found that between 2005 and 2010, there were only about 250 net new social housing units in the whole province, 250 over 5 years. So the amount of new housing that's being built is minuscule. We do have 14 sites that the community, our community in the downtown east side, fought for, that the city bought and the province is funding. They were supposed to be built by the end of 2010, but two of them haven't even been started yet. So, and three of them in the downtown east side, I think three or four, opened this year. So there are more social housing units opening this year than have opened in previous years. However, the city is also encouraging property owners to upgrade SRO hotels, which is kind of the last resort for homelessness. And the number of rooms that we've counted where landlords are upscaling them and pushing rent beyond what people on welfare and disability and seniors on pension can afford is actually higher than the number of new units that have opened.
Well, I've been asking a few quick questions as we compare the rights of homeless people in different cities. So on these ones, if you could give me fast answers, even yes or no, if it works. Is it legal in Vancouver for a homeless person to sit on the sidewalk during the daytime?
I think so, so long as they're not in certain places, like within 6 meters of an ATM or things like that.
Is it legal for a homeless family to sleep in a public place?
I think if there was a homeless family with children, that their children would be apprehended immediately. And businesses hire security guards to move sleeping homeless people off the sidewalks.
Okay. Is there anywhere in the greater Vancouver area where homeless people can legally pitch a tent to live in?
Not that I know of.
Is it legal to sleep in a car or camper in Vancouver?
I think so, but I'm not positive.
Does Vancouver have public washrooms accessible to the homeless?
A very, very few.
Are homeless people in Vancouver found dead on the streets each winter?
Yes. Well, I think there were at least two last year.
And can a homeless person vote in elections?
Yes, if they can go through all the hoops and rigmarole that's required to get on the voters list.
Right.
But it is technically possible.
And the final question, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you rate Vancouver police if 10 is where officers protect the homeless and 1 is the homeless are generally harassed or even beaten by police? Your rating of the Vancouver Police Department?
Well, probably a 2 or a 3.
Well, yes, because we had the missing women's inquiry and so many things where people went missing and were murdered and the police didn't act on it. We've just got an inquiry in that now. Well, Gene, we've talked about some of the wins for homeless people in Vancouver, such as they are. What are some of the things that still need to be done?
Well, a big thing is that's happening in downtown Eastside is gentrification. So the city is encouraging more developers to build condos. The condos push up land values. It pushes up the rents in the hotels. It pushes up the taxes in the businesses that serve low-income people, and low-income people are pushed out, or the community that they feel comfortable in is totally changed. So gentrification is big, and we're working really hard to stop it in the downtown east side, at least until we can get social housing for everyone who lives there that they can afford. Another thing is we desperately need federal and provincial governments to put in money to build social housing, and we desperately need the city to buy lots, which is their role, to put the social housing on. They have a policy of buying one lot a year in the downtown east side, and they haven't bought any for 3 years. So the policy, we're trying to work to get them to stick to their own policy, and the downtown east side neighborhood council and Carnegie Action Project have a campaign to get the city to buy 10 sites a year for the next 5 years so they can replace the SRO hotels, which are completely inadequate, bedbug-ridden, no bathroom, no kitchen, tiny 10-by-10 rooms that no one should be forced to live in.
What is an SRO? What does that stand for?
Single room occupancy. It's a room in a hotel, but it's a residential hotel, and people pay by the month. And they have to share a bathroom with everyone on their floor, and they don't have kitchens, and they're often very poorly managed and unsafe, but they're better than the street.
Can you give us your organization website and tell us how people could help?
The website is capvancouver.wordpress.com. I can't recall. The Downtown Eastside Neighborhood Council has a website too, but I don't know exactly what it is. But you could Google that. And if they live in Vancouver, what they could do to help is write to the mayor and council and tell them they should be buying 10 sites a year for the next 5 years to replace the SROs. And they should be lobbying federal government and provincial government fiercely to put money into social housing that people on welfare can afford. and that they should stop gentrification in the downtown east side until people who live there now have the housing that they need.
I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with the well-known anti-poverty organizer, Gene Swanson. Thank you so much, Gene.
You're welcome.
What about us? How to live?
A healthy
life. Just still to live.
Just
to tonight. I want to know. Belong to you, tell me why you're.